the one that won the most were like the massive major buyout, you know, low interest rate private equity firms. Like there is sort of a dominant asset class to investor analogy. And I guess what I'm saying is like, I think there's some model here that's like a hybrid of both trading and venture that probably is the dominant, but we haven't seen yet the like Paulter Jones style being able to make it across market cycles, make it across decades. But my hypothesis that it's going to be somewhere between venture and trading.
Hey, everyone. Wanted to give a quick shout out to the Wormhole Foundation. If you are a Bell Curve listener, you know that transferring across chains can be a massive pain. I certainly do. I complain about it on this program all the time. That's why we are super pumped to have partnered with the Wormhole Foundation, the stewards of the Wormhole Protocol. The Wormhole Protocol connects over 30 blockchains and 6 different runtimes, including Solana, Sui, Ethereum, Layer 2s, and more. And the coolest part about this particular partnership is that they have made custom Bell Curve NFTs, which you can get and mint for free. You can claim that by just going down into the show notes and clicking on the link. All right, guys, on with the show. Hey, everyone. Wanted to give a quick shout out to this episode's sponsor, Flood Protocol, the optimal DEX aggregator. Now, if you are a listener of Bell Curve, you know that MEV is a massive problem, which is why we are so pumped to partner up with Flood on this season. Flood is the only gasless and MEV-free aggregator that not only gets you the best execution, but also gives you back all the extra surplus that you create every single time you swap. Now, this is relevant for both swappers and developers, but you're going to be hearing all about them later in the program. So for now, thank you, Flood, and back to the show. Hey, everyone. This episode is brought to you by Uniswap, delivering the best on-chain trading experience in crypto, period, bar none. One thing I want to call out is the Uniswap extension. So say goodbye to these days of these annoying sort of pop-up wallet extensions. You lose your place trading. You have to open it back up. Uniswap now has a nice, sleek sidebar that persists no matter where you are on the web. It's much easier to use. If you click the link at the bottom of this episode, you can join the waiting list. And I'll see what I can do to get you moved up that waiting list. But definitely go click the link. Check it out.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Bell Curve. Before we jump in, quick disclaimer. The views expressed by my co-host today are their personal views, and they do not represent the views of any organization with which the co-hosts are associated with. Nothing in the episode is construed or relied upon as financial, technical, tax, legal, or other advice. You know the deal. Now, let's jump into the episode.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to another Bell Curve Roundup. You got Michael and Vance today, and maybe Michael one or two will join us. Yeah.
We'll see.
He's late.
We're starting.
Yeah. And we could just jump right into it, actually. And I want to get your take on, we were just chatting a little bit before we hopped on here about this, maybe brooding drama a little bit in between Aave and Maker. So earlier this week, you know, we saw Mark Zeller, who's an extremely important delegate or a stakeholder generally to the Aave protocol. You know, he was tweeting about, you know, what he viewed as, you know, quote, reckless behavior from Maker. So they've got this partnership with Athena, which also launched this week, pretty successful launch, I would say. And they're sort of loaning out DAI to be farmed on the Athena protocol. And the Mark Zeller take was, hey, this is basically a non-battle-tested protocol, weak oracles, asset hypersensible to market conditions. I'm just reading some of the quotes of his tweet. And initially, they were talking about proposing an LTV reduction in DAI and Aave today. But then I saw even potential talks, like Stani retweeted about maybe not like seriously limiting DAI on the Aave protocol in general. And I think maybe to editorialize a little bit or give some context is, you know, there were kind of these three protocols that I would have called like the hallmarks of DeFi 1.0. I mean, Uniswap, but Uniswap is in sort of its own sort of little corner, where I would say like Curve, Maker, and Aave each sort of had their thing. There was a stable coin, a stable swap, and borrow lend. And a little while ago, it seemed like each of these protocols started to infringe on each other's territory a little bit, right? So Aave launched Go, Curve launched CRV USD, Maker is expanding its own remit a little bit. And, you know, what started as kind of this very neat narrative about money Legos, where, you know, they each, like Aave and Maker, I would say, were, you know, key components in each one of, like the Aave adoption of DAI was a big component in DAI adoption in the early days. But now it's starting to look like they're a little bit competitive with one another. And it kind of raises this question of, okay, Ave, is this really, are you putting your risk mitigation hat on here, or are you putting your strategy hat on and you're trying to limit DAI in some way, shape, or form? So I'd be curious what, hey, Michael, what's going on, buddy? I'd be curious what your guys' read on this whole situation was.
So let me give you a little bit of backstory before we get into it. So this kind of like kerfuffle has been brewing for probably a year. Spark is a fork of Aave V3. There's a revenue share there. There's still some like chippiness about, you know, it's open source, but like only if we use it on the Aave side. And like, I don't think that's exactly the right take. Obviously, when you see something like Spark grow to, it's probably at like three or four. No, it's, I think it's higher than that. It's probably like 5 billion, you know, TVL in the protocol. That's share that frankly was stolen from, or not stolen, but just gained from Aave and Go. Obviously, Aave launched Go, which is the other part of this. They have competing stable coins. But I think the crux of the issue is like, there's kind of this like, there's two sides of the lending marketplace, at least in ETH DeFi. It's like the Aave-centric lending style. And then there's like the Athena, Morpho, Maker, Spark camp. And the two camps are obviously separated by, number one, the stablecoin. That's the base unit of account. And like the latter ecosystem of Athena, Spark, Maker, you know, they're just growing DAI supply. The other kind of crux of the differences are, like, what does the future of lending, what is the best construction of a lending market going forward for ETH? So, or for really anything DeFi. So like, if you think about what happened last year in Aave when Curve was pretty close to getting liquidated and they, in a lot of people's eyes, were pretty irresponsible with just like how they were setting governance. And there's all these like backroom communications trying to like find the situation. That's one camp. The other camp is Morpho, which is like, isolated lending markets, kind of looks like RARI from last cycle, where you have people underwriting specific markets that are individually collateralized. And like the risk or the benefit there is like, if it blows up, it only blows up that one market. Mm. Whereas with Aave, like they were looking at significant negative debt that would have been probably a haircut across all depositors if Curve ended up blowing up. So I think like the specific concerns are mostly a massaging of the information to make Maker look bad. And I think this is in the face of A, them losing a lot of share to the other ecosystem, and B, frankly, like I don't think the Aave model is the future of lending. I think it has to be these isolated markets, because that's the only way that you're going to be able to scale to like the long tail LRTs and all the collateral that people want to use today in a safe way. So I think it's like kind of sour grapes a little bit. A little bit of cope from the Aave side.
But I don't know if Michael, if you had anything to add, but I'm curious to get, and just for folks, when you talk about the more isolated markets, like Morpho's model, to be honest, I'm not an expert, but I understand that it's sort of a P2P model, like layer that sits on top of Aave and actually directly matches people. And the advantage would be it's more capital efficient, because on the Aave side of things, you obviously have to over collateralize the loan, so there's some amount of just idle capital that's sitting there, and in a P2P matching sort of environment, you don't have to plan for that type of thing. Is that roughly right, or could you say a little bit more about like your P2P vision of the future events?
You can do other stuff. Like if I'm an underwriter of one pool, I can choose to automatically underwrite other pools with either similar collateral or people that, you know, I know and trust who have underwritten them. And so you do have like the cross collateralization of markets. I think a lot of what it comes down to is also just governance. Like, are you getting the whole community to vote on every single change to every single interest rate curve and new type of collateral that wants to be accepted? Because like that increases the vector for politics and like, you know, self-dealing to happen. And like the Curve scenario was like totally like, if we want to talk about risk management, like that was the closest that DeFi has gotten to a serious body blow in the past couple of years. But like if you have these individualized markets, like it constrains the risk, but also the governance surface area, which is like generally the area that we should be moving towards, like less human intervention in these markets and less room for like political attacks from like one competitor to the other. Like that's just like, I don't think has a place in crypto.
not to say that I agree with this, but to strawman the other side, I will say, you know, to your point on Athena in particular, there is a lot of human intervention at this point. I think Athena will be able to de-risk a lot of this as they move towards decentralized perps. And I know that that's the plan. The plan is to eventually have, you know, Athena run off of something like a synthetics perps or any other options that live on chain. But right now they can't get enough of the funding rate to be able to find to be able to farm that just with centralized. So I think that there's a move where a lot of this consternation, a lot of the sour grapes gets de-risked as things like Athena or any other qualms that may come up eventually on the individual lending side get squashed over time. But I think that that move right now, it's kind of an easy target. And, you know, it's moving in the direction of decentralization, but just calling that out is something that it's not a non-zero risk, just given the construction that they have right now. But I think they're moving in the right direction.
The ultimate risk for Athena that has like, you know, 15 or 20% of open interest on these exchanges is like somehow the money is lost. And they use custodians that are industry standards. Don't want to like put them here, but like we use some of these same custodians. They have insurance, they have all this type of stuff. And Athena also has an insurance fund in case anything were to happen. But I think like what could happen is basically like these centralized exchanges effectively like try to hunt Athena in some way. Like something happens or there's some slippage, they try to close out a position and the exchange just says, you know what, like you've got a couple billion on this. Maybe I'll just clip 100 million from you and see if
I mean, or their account gets locked, like, or there's, right. You know,
totally. But if it, to Michael's point, if it happens on decentralized perps, that removes most of this ability, but then you,
and that's the direction that they're moving.
Right. You do introduce smart contract risk, but like, if that's the ultimate criticism, we all have smart contract risk. So
yeah.
I'm not quite sure where that is from.
I've got a question for you guys. Here's another, I haven't heard anyone articulate this, so maybe it's just a stupid idea, but one other risk that I see with Athena, and by the way, I'm in the camp that a lot of these risks are sort of overblown. Like you see all these people comparing Athena to Luna, and that's just, I just think that's totally different ballpark. I don't know where you guys sit on that, but doesn't seem like the same thing at all to me.
It's not the same thing.
Yeah, not the same thing. But you know what? One of the, I mean, basically what they're doing, right, is they're democratizing access to the basis trade. And I think it's really smart because we had this interview will air next week, but Nick from DRW, Cumberland DRW, I chatted with him earlier this week. That was a great intro. Thanks, Vance. And, you know, we were talking about Athena and what he mentioned was, like, part of the reason why this basis trade still exists is there's just an imbalance of, you know, supply and demand of capital to actually, like, that's willing to close the spread down. I guess the question from me to the Athena team is, what happens when you fix that supply-demand imbalance, right? There's, like, a V1 of this, which is really easy, which is just, like, keep all your assets in, like, staked ETH, right? And then you either do, like, some mix of centralized or decentralized exchanges to go short the perp. But then what happens once that revenue kind of goes down? Like the Athena team is going to have a choice to just shrink the protocol, right? And assets are going to leave, or you're going to look for more risky collateral potentially than Steeth or some other way to like keep the growth engine going. And like that to me, like once they've maxed out the natural amount of yield that comes from that basis trade, like that's going to be a really pivotal strategic question for Athena, the protocol. Like, that's one of the risks that I see, actually.
I mean, we're in a structural bull market right now, which means that, and there is always sort of a natural bias towards the funding rate leaning more towards the positive skew either way. But right now, the positive skew is much higher, just given that there's much more demand to go long than there is to go short. The thing that we won't have ever tested, it's kind of like what we used to say back in like 2020 or 2019, like we haven't seen crypto exist when we had interest rates above zero. Like we haven't seen Athena exist when we've had a negative bias for a long period of time. It's happened in short periods of time over the last, you know, couple weeks, months, as it's been live and scaled. But to your point, Mike, if you get to tens of billions of float and that 10-15% of funding actually gets to be like 50, 60, 80%, there is a big question as to whether or not, you know, the yield is going to be worth the risk. And that's where we'll find sort of an even middle ground. But at that point, it's still pretty massive.
I mean, when funding goes negative, they basically turn off the short position and then they just get the staking yield, which is like considerably less, but it's also denominated in ETH. So like, you know, maybe you're getting 3% in a bear market, but you think that 3% will go to 12%, you know, if it quadruples. Like that's kind of what you're playing for at that point. But the closing out of the short is the interesting part. Like just a scaled down example, like say you were trading like a DeFi coin or a gaming coin and you were, you know, 12% of the open interest or more, and you tried to close that out. Like that would be very hard to do. You might incur significant amounts of slippage, which would eat into the yield that you're giving people. And you wouldn't know until you tried to withdraw, right? Or until they tried to fix the issue and close out the short. So like there are risks for sure. But I also think like just to get back to the original Abe point, like the maker model is taking more risk now. That's the point. Like we're in a bull market. Like the yields are extremely high. Like this is the time where you have to do that. But like to say it's like an existential risk or like in totally like, I don't think that's true at all.
That's where I sit too. People have to remember the Luna model, the whole stablecoin was collateralized by equity in the protocol, which is to say it's not collateralized by anything at all. Right. Like, so.
There's apparently $1 billion of Bitcoin though that was backstopping it.
what happened to that? The Luna Foundation guard. Whatever happened to those guys?
I think they're on trial right now.
They broke up. They didn't make it.
Yeah. Damn. I want to give a shout out actually to. I guess this has been a little bit of an open secret for a while, but it's like semi, I've seen him tweeting about it. So I guess we could talk about it, which is Kobe's new thing, which is Echo .xyz, which I think some of our analysts are like early beta users of it. But from what I understand, Kobe's trying to create a platform, which is going to democratize access to like seed stage or very early stage deal flow in crypto. So I guess the idea is that in addition to raising from like the frameworks of the world or whoever, like blue chip investors and angels, et cetera, you would also have kind of a community portion. And maybe in the most charitable way, like the benefit is that, okay, you still have like the cap table that you want, like the frameworks or the paradigms or whatever, and angels for all the strategic sort of investor helping stuff. But it's actually nice to engage a portion of the community as well and have like the community on your side. So maybe you have some kind of allocation to them. And maybe that's the way that you also avoid some of the adverse selection problem that crowdfunding platforms like Kickstarter typically has, right? Because like from the founder perspective, you don't want your entire cap table to be like 10,000 random degens on the internet, right? Like that's not a good idea either. So it'd be a cool idea if it worked. Like I'm rooting for it for sure.
Yeah.
What do you guys think?
Well, let's just say this. I think that there's a pretty common practice right now where you have a known person influencer round of individuals, you know, later in the process, kind of close to launch. And I think that you know, what that does is it builds a group of people that are able to be knowledgeable, be invested, and be able to talk about it, you know, right before, you know, the product or service, whatever it is, launches. I think that there is a room for that. I think doing it in a like really transparent way, it'll just be interesting. This stuff has been tested before. You know, there were syndicates that were put together in 2017. There were, we've invested alongside, you know, groups of people that have pooled capital together. And I think a lot of that does work. I think it's hard to have a really, like angels play a distinct role in any of these, you know, investing ecosystems and opportunities. I think it's hard for angels to necessarily, it's hard for projects to find a massive group of angels that are going to be really bought in specific to that product or service. And so that's where I think being able to discern like who are going to be the right fit for whatever it is that I'm building, who are going to be the ones that can represent this, who are going to be the ones that can talk about this the right way, that I think will be an interesting test to see if Echo can cover all the bases. versus just like be a generalist angel platform. But I mean, I think that we are in the world of financial innovation, and if this becomes a new model for capital fundraising and getting it into a hands of a bunch of people that are going to use it and talk about it, that's a great thing.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, we like Kobe, support him. I think also, you know, maybe this cures some of like the, we only do projects if they're like these totally ironic meme coin vibes. Cause like, I'm assuming you'll have to have a real project if you're IPOing, ICOing, whatever on this platform. And yeah, if you can figure it out, you know, regulatory wise, I think it's cool. And I think ICOs did bring something to the whole game. Yeah. It was more so like you read the white paper that was like at least like some veneer of like trying to accomplish something. So maybe this helps that. I think it's cool. I also hope that it's not the same influencers getting the allocations. I don't think it will be. But we've seen so many of these like influencer rounds, not that this is related to Echo specifically, but like, it feels like there's the VC rounds, the influencer rounds, and then public. So there's like room in there for something else.
Yeah.
And like we like Coinless too. We think getting tokens into the hands of real people is important.
Yeah. I think there is why this has been a challenged model in the past is like from the founder perspective, I mean, even those two groups that you mentioned, like VCs, add value, like good VCs. I think that's another part of this conversation is like, I'd be curious from your guys' perspective, like what percentage of crypto VCs today do you think are like good value add VCs versus like slightly less? So maybe a slightly smaller portion than the total stock of crypto VCs that exist. But but generally if you get good VCs, they're super, super helpful, right? And like angels for the most part are helpful. Like, I don't know. I think people tend to look at this from the perspective of like, what is fair, right? And like, it feels like retail should get access to the same opportunities. But from like, at least my perspective, it's like a builder, you know, Blockworks doesn't have a token, but there's like keeping your cap table simple and small is beautiful. And I would prefer to optimize towards that than almost anything else, to be honest. And so that is, I think, the challenge that you run into, at least from the builder standpoint. But I don't know.
It's a lot of communications with investors if you have, you know, go from 10 to 1,000.
Yeah.
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 Different regulations too. I'm curious how this is being done. I mean, if there's like an interesting structure here, maybe that enables just more people to take part in it, which is cool.
Kobe, if you're listening, man, come on the show. I know there are these things like channels apparently. And you can, I guess maybe there's, I'm really speaking, I don't know if this is the case, but my assumption would be that maybe you could like copy invest, you know, once you're on the platform, you can kind of set up a channel. And if you're like, oh, like Vance, like is really good taste. Like I want to get access to the stuff that he's investing in early. Like maybe you could do some of that. But I don't know. We should get Kobe on the show to talk about it.
I like it.
Hey everyone, wanted to give a quick shout out to the title sponsor of this season of Bell Curve, the Wormhole Foundation. Now, if you are an on-chain user, which I bet you are, if you're listening to Bell Curve, you know that the cross-chain experience in crypto still sucks. Let's just call a spade. We talk about it on this program all the time. Interop is still a big problem, which is why we specifically wanted to team up with the Wormhole Foundation. They are a decentralized interop platform that powers multi-chain applications and bridges. So that could be anything from DeFi to NFTs, governance, oracles, and more. So if you are a developer and you're building cross-chain assets, apps, or data, or anything like that, I highly recommend that you click the link at the bottom of this episode and go check out to see what you can build on Wormhole. And Wormhole, first of all, this is a fun team. They did something really cool with us. You can actually go and click the link at the bottom of the screen, which is going to send you to a landing page where you can claim your own unique Wormhole NFT. So we're doing this with me and we're doing this with Jason, my co-founder. So help a brother out. It's a super cool NFT. I promise. Go click the link at the bottom of this episode and fill out your POAP, get your free NFT. And if you're a dev, head over to Wormhole and check out to see what cool cross-chain stuff you can build. Hey everyone, want to give a quick shout out to this episode's sponsor, Flood Protocol, the optimal DEX aggregator. Now, Flood is the perfect partner for this episode on the multi-chain future because Flood is solving so many of the issues that we're going to be talking about this season. And this is relevant for both traders and devs. So if you are a trader, you should definitely head over to FloodSwap and start trading because they solve three massive problems. One, gasless trading. No more pesky trading fees. Two, you don't have to worry about getting front run. MEV free. And then three, they have excellent order routing so that you know that you are getting the best price. So head over to FloodSwap and click the link in the bottom of the show notes. We're going to send you right there. For the devs out there, you can leverage Flood's flexible hooks, allowing you to make swapping a first-class primitive by adding custom order types like TWAPs. Or if you're a wallet builder or something like that, you can actually build your own order flow auction in and start recapturing a bunch of that MEV. If you want to reach out to them, go to devs@flood.bid or just jump right in the Discord. All right, guys. Thanks very much. Appreciate you, Flood. Hey, everyone. This episode is brought to you by Uniswap, delivering the best on-chain trading experience, period, bar none, in all of crypto. Here's how I would divide the protocol today. There's a web part, a mobile part, and an extension part. You can say goodbye to the pop-up wallet extension. It's just not great from a UX perspective. Now what they've delivered is this nice, clean sidebar where you can just very easily track swaps, sign transactions, send or receive crypto anywhere. Just a huge UX improvement. On the web part of it, huge improvements here. You can buy and sell 700 plus tokens at your price, on your terms, and they've got limit orders, which are powered by Uniswap X, and there's gasless. They've also got real-time charts, transaction logs, pool data, project information, all this cool stuff that just really improves your UX trading on the web. And again, all of this is powered by the smartest protocol in terms of Uniswap or Uniswap X. Click the link at the bottom. Uniswap extension is in alpha right now, and we'll see what we can do about getting you moved up that list. Thank you very much, Uniswap. All right, maybe we should talk a little bit about, I don't know if you guys saw the story that the United States, which is one of the largest holders of Bitcoin generally, maybe sold a little bit of Bitcoin this week. This was telegraphed from a long time ago, actually. They filed to sell like $130 million worth of Bitcoin for at least like 3 or 4 months ago. So I don't think it should be a wild surprise, but maybe that has a little bit to do with the recent price action that we've seen, or frankly, maybe it was just, this is one of those things that happens in bull markets and we were always going to sell off a little bit in range because it can't be up only forever. But what do you guys make of this news?
I mean, the government's got to find a way to replenish that SPR.
or any of the other shit that they won't correctly finance it to.
Dead Pirate Roberts, Dread Pirate Roberts funding the government.
I know.
I mean, do we know, like, I didn't track it other than the movement to Coinbase, I guess. And that was sort of, I think that was 2000 Bitcoin. Is it like for sure that it was sold? I never really kind of followed the end of the trail.
Not really. No, it's honestly, I kind of have that. I feel like I think there are supply in the market matters an enormous amount, but I sort of feel like by the time that it also is, you know, every once in a while you'll hear, remember about a year ago, there was all this like, oh, the, you know, Mt. Gox claims are finally, you know, going to make their way to market. And there were a couple Twitter accounts that were like, this is super bearish and yada, yada. And it's like, I feel like by the time the supply FUD reaches like this, like when you're hearing about it on a podcast, like you probably don't have to worry about it that much.
I mean, the other thing too is I feel like people are still living in the like 2018, 2019 days of liquidity in markets where like the market structure has fundamentally changed. I mean, we have BlackRock and Fidelity ETFs. We're about to get options on them. There's about to be more ETFs in the next couple of months. I don't know, like the structure of this industry has fundamentally changed. We're selling $2 billion of Bitcoin in some way, shape or form. Maybe it's a forward contract. Maybe they bought options to hedge the price. Like who knows how they're doing this, but they also have a duty to make sure that they get the best execution. And they're not dumb. They're going to be talking with, you know, maybe the Galaxies of the world who are going to help facilitate this type of transaction. Like this stuff, I think, is actually a lot more easily absorbed by the market. And we should stop thinking like a $2 billion sale of Bitcoin market sale on Coinbase is going to kill the entire industry. It feels a little bit hyperbolic.
I mean, BTC traded $30 billion over the past 24 hours.
Precisely.
Like, come on. I mean, there is like the signaling of more supply in the market, but I remember when these things used to drop the market like 15, 20% and it would like stay there for a few months. This didn't drop below 65 and it's like, you know, it's 68 almost today. I think it just underscores the persistent bid that you have from a variety of sources, one of which is the ETFs.
It's just a larger, more mature market than it used to be. You know, like, it's just, I agree. It's just totally different structure. You know what is a good, have you guys ever read this book, Market Wizards?
Oh, yeah.
Of course.
So I just saw that it was for free on, I guess Spotify now has audiobooks and they're giving some amount out for free. And I saw there's a free audiobook. So I just kind of listened to some of the old interviews. Dude, some of these guys have totally blown up. I don't know if you've looked at, I've looked up like what happened to these guys post Market Wizards, and the majority of them like blew their whole stack. But Paul Tudor Jones is in there.
And there's this section is with an accent too, with the Southern accent. Yeah.
Yeah. There's some timeless wisdom there. And I do think there's an analogy. Like if you hear these guys, they're talking about trading soybean futures contracts in like the 70s, but there's a lot of analogies to what it sounds like trading crypto today. So I don't know, just timeless stuff about like what you were saying, Vance, like you can't get out at the top because there's no liquidity at the top. So like basically just if you're trading in size, get out while you can. There's some great, as they'd say, lessons in there, you know?
Oh yeah. But like, I think the converse side of that is like all of these experiences happened once.
Yeah.
Like Paul Tudor Jones was trading like soybeans and cotton and then like currencies. And like, that's where he came from. Like we're definitely in a different branch of finance. If people want good books, I think the three or four best ones that I know on trading are Market Wizards, Soros on Soros, More Money Than God by Sebastian Mallaby. But to your point, most of these guys have blown up. Some of them have systematized. Paul Tudor Jones is interesting because they like literally like tried to document what he did and like reverse engineer a programmatic strategy to trade like Paul Tudor Jones, and they couldn't do it. It's just like, it's like all feel. And his whole thing is like, I only trade like the inflection points and I trade it with a lot of leverage. And if I'm like down 10%, I cut. So all these guys kind of have different strategies, but I think More Money Than God is probably the best, like, multi-cycle view on you know the best people, and to your point, most of them have blown up. Tiger was revered for its strategy at the time of writing of that book, and you know now the jury's kind of out.
Also a great doc on I can't remember the name of it, but there's a great doc on Paul Tudor Jones where he like goes down to his house in Virginia and he's like trading over the phone that's connected to the wall, and he's like waking up at 5 o'clock in the morning East Coast so they can trade Asia hours. He's a legend.
Dude, and like the role of technology and where information sharing happens now is so much different than it was before. Like,
yeah,
to Michael's point, like the Soros on Soros book, he's like reading a newspaper in a gondola in Switzerland while he's skiing, and he gets like an idea from it. You know, these people are reading newspapers. Like there's no 24/7 real-time information flow. It's a different game. All those guys would trade crypto if their career started today, but they would be way different.
I agree. There's actually a guy in that book, Richard Dennis. I don't know if that name rings a bell, but he was one of the inspirations, like early inspirations to PTJ. And he actually, to prove a point with a friend that you could teach traders, brought these like 20 or 30 analysts on that he called the turtles. And he gave them like a simple trend following strategy and it all worked. And it was like, it's just funny because he proved at the time of this reading that you can teach someone to be a trader. And then like a year after this, he had to close all of his funds, he just lost it. And none of those turtles ended up being successful. They made like $200 million in a couple of years. And then it just, none of it worked ever again. So
here's a question. And I don't even know the answer to it, but I'm still thinking about it. why is it that there aren't any people in crypto? If this is, you know, let's put this to the electronification of the stock exchange, or like trading commodity futures in the 80s and the early or late 70s. Why isn't there like a Paul Tudor Jones of crypto from a trading perspective? Someone who has systematically beaten the market consistently, hasn't blown up yet. I mean, in every cycle you have like, you would have said Three Arrows maybe, but like, it turns out they actually didn't know what they were doing, the whole thing, or didn't do risk management properly. But, you know, I don't know, just a hypothetical, like, why isn't there someone who you can point to and be like, oh, that's the Stephen A. Cohen, the Paul Tudor Jones, the blah, blah, blah of this cycle, of this asset?
I think we're getting there. But Paul Tudor Jones was like a multi-decade phenomenon.
Yeah.
Same with most of these guys.
And I mean, sure, but he PTJ started in like 83, 84 and kind of like, you know, I guess he started trading a little bit earlier than that, but like he built his firm in the 80s and, you know, survived crashes and everything. I'm just saying, because I think, you know, my hypothesis is that it's a totally different market structure again, and trading in the same way that they did is maybe not the best system or the best strategy for participating in these markets. It may be a short-term way to participate, but I think a liquid strategy or a trading strategy, you know, may not be the thing that works, just in the same way that Paul Tudor Jones is an venture investor.
Mm-hmm. Maybe, I mean, Michael, maybe there are Paul Tudor Joneses, you just don't know them yet, because like even at the time of this, like 89, I think was when Market Wizards was all those interviews happened. I think the net worth of most of these guys was anywhere from like hundreds. 80 million to like, yeah, hundreds of millions, right? They're not, it's not like the billionaire, you know, that Paul Tudor Jones was today. There are probably like, frankly, like these, some of these like anon accounts, right? Who just like, maybe, you know, their Twitter, maybe they're not on Twitter, but they probably just like kind of quietly traded their way to like, you know, mid to low nine figure stacks. And like, maybe one of those guys or gals just ends up like making it for the next 30 years, right? And then you'll know who they are.
The Obi-Wan wallet.
Yeah.
I mean like, I don't know. I mean, you can see these things on chain. Like, we can track them on chain. Like, there hasn't been someone who has been able to consistently make it across market cycles.
The one of the more meta points is like, if you added up all the crypto that all the big funds own, you know, how much do you think they would own relative to the total market cap? So to call the total market cap $2 trillion of crypto assets. How much do all the crypto funds own? $30 billion? It's like not that much. It's like 1%, 2%, maybe 3%. I think probably 1 or 2.
I mean, there's $1 trillion of that is Bitcoin, and you assume 20 to 25% of that is lost. And
yeah. Totally. Like, you can definitely haircut it, but none of the funds are big enough yet to be the Paul Tudor Joneses of the world. Like, the super brief summation of More Money Than God is like, Tiger is trading equities in like the 80s. Paul Tudor Jones is trading like commodities in the 80s. They kind of like do this like relative value trading of each. Those markets get constrained, then they all move to trade macro. And that's kind of like when Paul Tudor Jones really kills it. Tiger like does really well, but like less on the currency side. That's like when George Soros really comes on the scene as like the king of the macro traders. But these are huge markets. And I think it like, you know, the peak Tiger was, I mean, 50, 60 billion AUM in 1900s.
I mean, in 2021, there were hundreds.
50, 60 billion probably in the 90s, but like relative to today's value of the dollar, that's probably like 100 billion. And they were just levered. So these ones are huge. And I think until we get there, it's going to be hard to see the Paul Tudor Joneses.
I agree with that. There's another angle that you could take on this as well, which is like, there's a hedge fund sort of trading component to this, which looks like some of those like Paul Tudor Jones guys, currencies, commodities, et cetera. But then there's like a venture thing. And like one framework that stuck with me is there's a guy, Ron Chernow, who writes biographies of famous people. And he did one on John D. Rockefeller. It's called Titan. And John D., dude, probably one of the cooler business stories of all time. But if you go back to, this is like 1800s when he was building Standard Oil. But at that time, like also a lot of parallels to crypto industry. It was like oil was like the new sexy thing. There was like super, super cyclical because they would find like a new geyser of supply. Oil prices would crash. You know, there were like towns popping up overnight, millionaires, all that stuff, and then lost all their money, tons of similarities. And everyone had a really short-term mindset on it, but he just took a super long-term mindset. And his strategy basically was like, he was great at operations, that type of thing. But he had really good relationships with banks. So when the industry would like blow up, he would go get credit from the banks, buy up all of his competitors, and then wait for like the tide to come back, make a ton of money, wait for people to blow up, acquire them. And like, there are probably gonna be a couple power law winners like that in this case.
This is kind of what I was getting at, which is, I think for each asset class, for each period of time as well, there is a dominant like investment thesis, investment strategy that takes advantage. Like, if you were going to be the best investor from just like a taking a step back, who are the ones that won the most at a period of time? You know, you've got the Tigers in the 80s, maybe the early 90s, You've got maybe like the Paul Tudor Jones on the same time scale with like some of the macro trading as well. But in the late 90s, the people that won the most were like the Silicon Valley venture capitalists. In the 2000s, the one that won the most were like the massive major buyout, you know, low interest rate private equity firms. Like there is sort of a dominant asset class to investor analogy. I guess what I'm saying is like, I think there's some model here that's like a hybrid of both trading and venture that probably is the dominant, but we haven't seen yet the like Paul Tudor Jones style being able to make it across market cycles, make it across decades. But my hypothesis that it's going to be somewhere between venture and trading.
Yeah. I mean, just like interesting facts, and like benchmark is way more like compare benchmark to like Brevan Howard. Like, and they're like, they've roughly been alive for the same amount of years. Benchmark obviously has like, you know, crazy multiples on its fund. Brevan Howard is more kind of like year in, year out, 10, 20%, but it's liquid and you can withdraw and all that good stuff about hedge funds. But, you know, I think Benchmark has generated somewhere in the neighborhood of like 30 billion total profits. And Brevan Howard since inception has generated like 28 billion. And so like the aggregate profits are the same. One is just way more capital efficient. And frankly, like if you're more capital efficient, that's more performance for the people who run it.
I mean, what do you guys think? Like I sort of see what it feels like the most sophisticated funds are structured kind of like, yeah, like a framework or a paradigm or something like that, where it's like there's a more traditional VC portion of the book, which is just direct equity investments in companies, but then there's kind of like a liquid portion of the book as well. And I actually don't know how you guys structure it, but I know some funds are like, this is our, and they have like different teams, right? Where it's like, hey, this is our team that only does venture. This is our team that only does liquid. And the liquid guys kind of look more traditionally like hedge fund guys. And then the more traditional venture are venture guys. And I think Tiger actually today in its modern instantiation, Chase Coleman, right? I can't remember if he's the public market
he's
guy.
He's the public guy.
He now right. Now since Scott left.
Oh, really? Interesting.
He's in charge.
Yeah. Well, I guess Scott had a little tough run of it.
Yeah,
there
he had a tough bit. But Scott was the private, the venture investor, and Chase historically was the public. You know, the way the framework is structured may be slightly different from how other funds are structured. Our view is that over a period of time, crypto moves so fast that you have to be able to take advantage of whatever it is that's happening at that point in time. Mm-hmm. You know, the way we say it is like you have to be able to play the game on the field. And if you are doing multiple funds, doing multiple strategies, have multiple teams, it's hard to course correct because invariably you're going to have, you know, some group of people at the firm who are like, well, wait, I can't do any liquid stuff because this stuff's way too overpriced. Or like, wait, I can't do any venture stuff because, you know, nothing is working. So I think you kind of have to morph and kind of change to be able to adjust with the times. And I think a lot of the funds also have like the hedge fund structure and the venture fund sidecar. It's really tough, frankly, from like an LP perspective to do that. So, you know, our take is to have one fund at a period of time.
Yeah. And we're like a founder driven fund. Like we do all this stuff. And I don't think, I mean, it's weird. Maybe it does work for some people, but it's weird to think about like, I got my long short guy. I got my guy who only does like this one section of venture. I got like, you know, this guy who's like it smaller is better in a market like crypto where you can kind of keep it all in your head at once. As long as you're frankly on the ball 24/7.
And so some of the best DeFi investments have been buying tokens of protocols that have launched at low valuations. Some of the other best DeFi investments have been buying, you know, an equity with a token warrant before they've launched. It's all DeFi. And it just the mechanism in and of itself, I think, is the question. And that's where you see opportunities. And, you know, if you're someone who wants to cover DeFi, you should be able to do both. It's not like you need to be able to do one and you can only do that one.
I'll also say coming from a retail background, trading coins on exchanges and flipping ICOs way back in the day and all that stuff, like that's where all of our instincts come from. And obviously we have the venture background, but like we also know how to trade. And like if you never make if you've never made money in crypto before and you're coming at it from a pure venture perspective, it's probably hard to imagine like what being on Binance actually feels like. And that's just background that you need.
I've got a question for you guys on the founder side of things. What do you think, like, if you looked at the like dynastic founders, right, of the early internet era, it was like there were some common factors there. It was like guys that looked more like Jeff Bezos. And I don't know, like we've talked about this before, but one of the challenges that I think is maybe there's a lot of analogy to like a lot of comparisons to be made between like early to mid 90s internet and crypto now, because there's kind of this like separation between like kind of young, more inexperienced founders, but they get it. They're like crypto natives versus like, but they don't have some of the operational chops to like grow and manage like, you know, at some point thousand person teams or whatever, you know, thousands of employees versus some of the, I don't know, some of the Web2 founders I meet, they're like so polished, but I'm like, it doesn't feel like they're close to the metal on their like product or anything. You know what I mean?
So let me ask you this. What's the most successful example that we have? Let's say Amazon, maybe one of the most successful from 1993 when they started. What's the most successful example that we have?
In crypto, you mean?
In crypto. Like what's the most successful? I mean, just to speed run, I would say Ethereum and probably something like Solana and maybe something, you know, like the base alt layer ones that are doing really well, that have a lot of attention, a lot of activity. But look at the model of Ethereum. If Jeff Bezos is the canonical example from the 90s, Vitalik is the example for this era. It's a totally different construct where you're building a protocol. You're not building a company. Like eventually you want to be able to hand over the keys to the decentralized community and have it run by itself. And like, you get to be someone who, you know, writes thought pieces and helps, you know, steer thought and direction. Like that I think is kind of, I think if you're a Web3 founder, what you need to be aiming for. Now, if you're building a product or if you're building something that's built on top of a protocol, like that's a totally different equation. But I think if you're, you know, you're targeting something, you're kind of targeting that. Mm.
Yeah, I would say more international for sure.
Mm. That too.
More risk on from a regulatory perspective. I would say some of the DeFi founders are on the cusp of it. It's just like the market caps. I think you need to kind of get to be like 10 billion market cap to be like the, and frankly, some of these were there last cycle and it looks like they're could be going back. So I think like there will be a time for a different type of founder archetype to emerge, but the Web2 founders in like San Francisco, I don't know, they just don't seem built for crypto, and like the strangeness of it. And frankly, like it's a weird time in tech in general. Like what are the things that are working in like a traditional venture funds portfolio? Mm. Definitely not fintech. The last real consumer tech hit that we had was BeReal, but that has effectively been subsumed by the larger networks. You've kind of got AI, but that's like you're hunting elephants. You know, these are like $10 billion seed rounds or, you know, $1 billion seed round or something. Like it's definitely like there isn't as much opportunity in technology as there once was, or it's like very changed into a different form of being like crypto, AI, and then maybe like hard tech.
Hmm. I think there's a,
you know, people are building fucking defense companies and they're like Palmer Luckey is the archetype. Like it's really stratifying the types of founders that make it.
Here's something else that maybe is a little bit unique to crypto is like, if you just look at the last 15 years of tech or something, it's been a pretty steady grind upwards. Right. There haven't been like, it's like a little cyclical. Startup life is always super hard, but like, It's just something that I've noticed with founders that come from tech a little bit more is there's like the strategy is kind of like you just want to load up with as many like engineering sort of resources as possible, raise a bunch of money. And then like the assumption is like there's going to be some variability in your revenue, but not a ton. Whereas like the crypto founders that make it cycle over cycle, it's like you have to deal with like, I don't know, anywhere from 50 to 90% drawdowns in your revenue, like multiple times. And then you have to bring your entire team along with you. And there are other businesses out there like that are extremely pro-cyclical, like construction or gold mining and semiconductors or shit like that. But it's not, there's like no overlap between people with a tech background that like are used to working in pro-cyclical businesses versus like a lot of the pro-cyclical businesses are really like CapEx heavy, you know, kind of commoditized businesses today. That's another, I don't know how you guys think about that or how you've like coached founders around those inflection points, but
I mean,
that's,
look,
that's another one, dude. It's just tough.
I kind of disagree with that too.
I was going to say, I'm not sure I totally agree with that. Think about the arc of Amazon. Like there were years where they were at 90% drop from their IPO price and, you know, no revenue, not they're selling books over the internet. Nobody even cared about the internet. I mean, I also worked at Snap. You know, before the IPO, we had a great run up in the IPO. It dropped, you know, 60, 70% after the IPO. I happened to leave right about then. And then, you know, it went on this massive run up until 2021. And then it dropped 90%. Like the tech industry is kind of is known for these cyclicalities, whether it's something that's brought on by like the crypto macro cycle, drawing everything else or dragging everything else down, or, you know, interest rates and inflation getting out of hand in 2021 and COVID and craziness. I mean, I think if anything, like the tech industry is probably the most calloused to it. Sure, maybe it's not a 95% drop, but I think it's pretty common for people to experience that. It's much more uncommon for people to, you know, be on a Google-like rocket ship where every single quarter from your IPO is just up and to the right. Like that is not normal.
Same thing happened at Netflix, you know, went down 80, 90%. Same thing happened at Facebook where it was like, you know, are they going to make the mobile wave? And then even if you look at the attrition rates of startups, like I would say as a whole, if you thought about all the startups that were funded in 2021, probably 90% of those are dead. And that's just like when you're in tech or you're an entrepreneur, that's the risk you take. Like if you don't want to take that risk, like you can go sell mayonnaise at Procter & Gamble. But like everything else, there's going to be some ups and downs.
Yeah. All right. That's a really fair point. You know, Netflix was the first stock that I ever bought way back in the day.
Wow.
Yeah.
You knew.
Yeah.
How long did you hold on to it?
Actually, I sold it at like the absolute peak of top. Like 5 years
I held on to it. The absolute peak of top. So correlation.
But I rolled it into Roblox, so that was not a good choice. Yeah, I was honestly like my thought process there was just, you know, if you listen to young kids, I have this story that my dad hates telling, which is when I was in sixth grade, he was like, pick a stock and I'll put like, you know, $1,000 or $2,000 that into that stock for you. And I picked Apple at the time, which was like, dude, it was like $18 pre all the stock splits. It's probably, you know, 200x ago. And my dad thought it was overvalued, fibbed to me about it being buying Apple and bought like Polymer Tech something or other, which like was
bland. Oh, no.
And my sister did the same with Google. The company she picked is Google. It was like, honestly, little kids kind of have a decent read on like anything that young kids are super obsessed with, like can't live without. A decent barometer of the future, to be honest.
Everyone has these stories now of the thing that they didn't buy or they did buy or their friend bought that went 200x if they would have just held on to it. I feel like nobody had these stories like a decade ago because these companies weren't that big.
I've got a quick story. Vance knows this. My dad has a friend who played for the 49ers, won the Super Bowl in 95, gets like a $25,000, $50,000 bonus check for winning the Super Bowl. He was a backup tight end, like didn't even play, got traded the following year. Takes the entire Super Bowl bonus check. All of his teammates are like buying cars, going on vacations, going to Vegas. He's like, I don't know. I'm just going to put it into something that I know. And he's like, I've got this Apple computer. I'm just going to put it all into Apple stock. Well, it gets traded the following year away from San Francisco and ultimately forgets about this brokerage account. Like they're trying to send him the paper slips. His address has changed. He gets called back to become the offensive coordinator at UC Berkeley. And they're finally like, we found you. We've been holding on to this brokerage account for the last 30 years or however many it's been at that point, 20 years. And like, what do you want to do with it? It has $22.5 million worth of Apple stock in it.
I mean, that's literally the best investment strategy. It's just coma.
Yeah. I think there was a study that got published by Fidelity a while ago. This is going to sound a little morbid, but the people, you know who the cohort of people who did the best investing in Fidelity was? People that died.
Oh. That is incredible.
Yeah. So, I guess like last thing, is I would love to get your guys' perspective. I don't know if you have any exposure to this at all, but like the liquid restaking space. So this is like, obviously there's been an enormous amount of TVL that's gotten sucked into Eigenlayer, and everyone's extremely excited about whenever they end up launching. But there's this new, we've talked about on Bell Curve a number of times, but there's like a liquid restaking layer. So in the same way that you can get like a liquid voucher, which represents your share of a staking pool like Lido, you're going to eventually be able to get like a sort of essentially deposit certificate of wherever you're restaking to. And the dynamics of that are pretty different, much more heterogeneous construction under the hood than like a liquid staking token. But yeah, honestly, like if you look at the valuation of something like EtherFi, I think it's the leading one. I mean, that's trading at like a $7 or $8 billion valuation. I would just like be curious how you guys assess this whole space. And I'm not sure if we've ever really talked about this, but like, what's your read on the whole LRT space?
So I think like, let's take a step back and talk about what an LRT is. And essentially, you know, maybe in the parlance of Athena, what you're talking about doing is you're taking staked ETH as the base layer, and then you're adding another layer of yield on top of it. And the expectation is that other layer of yield will be worth the additional risk of you taking that asset and restaking it and putting it up as like the capital asset to be the security module for, you know, a new whatever, AVS, new protocol, whatever. The big question is, you know, I checked yesterday, Eigenlayer has 4 million ETH in it. And the expectation is that, you know, you're going to be using this ETH as the security layer to backstop these new AVSs that are going to come about. Well, what is the yield required from those AVSs or those new protocols such that it compensates stakers or restakers enough, in addition to the staked ETH rate, for the additional risk that they're taking? My guess is that, you know, 4 million ETH is probably slightly too much for there to be a nice democratized yield that is worth it. And so I think what we're going to see here is, and really I think, you know, EtherFi, it's kind of a proxy right now. It's sort of like the WorldCoin equivalent to an ADR for Sam Altman. I think EtherFi is kind of acting as like a proxy for what they expect Eigenlayer to do based off of the points that are being assumed and getting exposure to this restaking environment. We'll see where all of this lands. It just launched, so it's kind of hard to assess real value of something that has just launched. But I think that there's a ton of other restaking providers that are going to be launching in the next couple of weeks. And we're expecting that Eigenlayer is going to launch in the next couple of months. I also wouldn't be surprised if we start to see other restaking platforms that are competitive to Eigen pop up. And I think that it'll be a question as to how do you keep the TVL? And that question is really answered by what's going to be the yield that TVL can actually assume. Is it going to be an additional 4%, 5%, 6%? You know, instead of getting 3 or 4%, you're getting 10%. Maybe that's something that keeps it, but that means that you have to artificially limit the amount of yield that can go into it. Otherwise, it drops the percentage yield for everybody. And so it's this fine balance of, you know, what's going to be the inflection point? How much value is Eigen going to lose once they do their airdrop and launch, you know, everything? And once people see that APY, a lot of open questions.
Yeah, I mean, we think that there's probably at least one other approach that's going to be compelling in articulating, like, what is the end game for even like liquid staking protocols? Is it a smaller amount of restaked ETH? Is it, you know, like higher quality AVSs? Because there's a lot of AVSs on Eigen. Like, I'm sure some will be good. Some will probably be okay. Or is there kind of like other vectors of like economic alignment that they can offer, maybe even similar to something like a Cosmos, where they're kind of like the original vision of Cosmos was like this like venture kind of fund. And I don't think it's like a venture fund, but like something like a, like, you know, people take Mantle seriously because they've got the big treasury and it's shared communally. And if you're in, you're kind of part of that sector versus something that's like, you know, permissionless and hard to kind of ascribe the alignment to. So I think there's going to be a lot of interesting opportunities to earn yield on ETH. But it's going to be like, it's not just going to be like a unipolar, it's just Eigenlayer approach. We think there's probably going to be at least one more. And yeah, we've got a portfolio company announcing and hopefully the next week kind of what they're doing, which will be cool.
There'll be like multiple, like, well, here's a question. There'll probably be most likely different ecosystems, like a, I don't know, like a, you've already sort of got shared security on the hub, like the Cosmos hub is that to like some degree, but like maybe you'll get one in Celestia, maybe you'll get one in Solana. And the idea would be that, like even like a good example of why this might be necessary is it depends. It's like a balance sheet management thing. Like if your liabilities are denominated in Solana, like you could imagine a bridge, right? Where like your liabilities would be denominated in Solana. So you would actually need Solana restaking as opposed to ETH. So I kind of makes sense to me that there would be, I don't know. I guess there's one that's just like sort of an open secret that's launching that's going to try to be all token restaking. And then I think there are a couple that are launching in specific other ecosystems, but we could end the year with like five of these things, I would say. Like who knows?
Which one's the open secret?
I don't know. We'll let that be a secret for a little longer. So
yep.
Yeah, I don't know. Have you guys listened at all to Hasu and John Charbonneau on Uncommon Core? Did a really great episode on the whole ETH staking, like targeting a certain percentage of stake debate. Like, I don't know if you guys are.
Yeah, I'm not taking this seriously until it's like, you know, I'm glad that we have like the immune response of people throwing up all over this. I don't think they should touch the issuance curve. They should just leave it alone. But this is so far from even becoming like potential reality that kind of you kind of got to pick which CT debates you're going to get involved in versus not. We've kind of made our position clear, but I don't think there's a big risk of this actually going through.
Yeah. It's an interesting intellectual like divide. I see that I'd be on the don't touch the issuance curve either, but I see where they're coming from. And it's like, you can debate how real the like dilution generated yield really is, like the block reward type yield. So I get it. Like maybe there is a world where, you know, Ethereum network people want you to hold more canonical ETH as opposed to wrapped, but I feel like that ship has already sailed. So I
think we're so far past that. Like,
and I agree.
Growing so quickly,
yeah. That,
you know, politically that's going to be hard to push through. I also think, frankly, demand matters a lot more than supply.
Totally.
Like, totally. You know, growth, abundance mindset, we'll find people to buy it up. Let's just make it as good as possible. And that's where the ETH community is getting at in the fullness of time, which I think just means not touching it. Mm. So like we're not really concerned.
I've got one more question for you guys, is just in general investors here. Like every so I've started to see this argument pop up. So we just had Wormhole that had a massive airdrop. And I saw these arguments around Jito as well. Basically that it's a stimulus check for a particular ecosystem, right? Like when the Jito airdrop happened, that's a ton of wealth that got sort of created overnight. And theoretically people are going to, some people are going to hold Jito and some people are going to maybe rotate that into meme coins or something like that. Do you view these large airdrops as wealth creation events? Do you view it as maybe dilution? Because then I don't know, how do you just view these big airdrops? Or is it just, are people just trying to make something out of nothing and it's just a big airdrop and that's it?
It's a big airdrop. We're not doing like for the planet here. We're airdropping coins to roughly a similar type of people that we've been dealing with for the past few years. And the concentration of the wealth is what makes it real.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that people will trade it for meme coins or other stock or other coins or other, you know, they'll borrow against it. Like it's a wealth creation effect, but I'm so sick of the thought pieces about meme coins and airdrops and like, guys, like we don't need the expose. We get it.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I actually, Michael, I loved your take on meme coins last podcast that we did, but dude, it's like my entire feed. I just want it to stop at this point. I'm just begging these people to like just something more interesting than this. It's just not that
maybe Echo. Maybe Echo helps.
Yeah. Yeah. Honestly. Because the ICO thing actually was, it did feel more fair. Like these FTVs, I know you guys were on this page, but like maybe it doesn't matter now. It will matter at some point. I don't know.
Yes. Also, I think like the worldview of like you can only have meme coins or like more fundamentally coins going up and you can't have them at the same time is just like so untrue. Just like looking at our portfolio, like we're doing fine.
Yeah.
Like, and if you're not invested in meme coins and you're not investing in fundamental coins, like what are you invested in? Like I don't know who the upset parties are in this market. It's kind of hard to tell who they are.
I don't know. Maybe people just want to chat shit.
I think it's people whose coins are not going up as like the daily top performer, which we've talked about. Don't do that.
I agree.
You'll be miserable forever.
Yeah. All right, fellas. Should we call it here? This is a good one.
All right. Later.
See you guys.
Later.
Hey everyone, Mike here. If you're a Bell Curve listener, you know that transferring assets across chains can be a massive pain. I certainly do. I complain about it on this program all the time. That is why we're incredibly excited to have teamed up with the Wormhole Foundation, the stewards of the Wormhole protocol. And the coolest part about this particular partnership is that they have made custom Bell Curve NFTs, which you can get and mint for free. Click the link at the bottom of this episode to get your free NFT.